Good evening, James McCanney here with my Science Hour, February 5th, 2015, going right into the show. It started last December. I started getting emails from people saying, you know, I can't get to your webpage anymore. And so, okay, well, you know, go to a different computer. Maybe you got a cookie, you're pulling up a cookie or something, who knows, you know, the typical thing. And so this goes on and on, and I'm going, you know, this is kind of strange. Some people can't get to my web page, and, you know, there was no correlation. Finally, somebody writes in, and they actually had it out with Verizon. They had Verizon Surface, and they were savvy enough to go to someplace else and then realize, maybe this is something with Verizon. So that's the first clue I had. Then I start getting other people, I have Verizon service and I can't get to your web page. So anyway, then the numbers start adding up, more and more and more people calling in, emailing, etc., saying, I can't get to your web page, and then Verizon. Okay, so it turns out Verizon is blocking my web page. Now, some of these people went to technical service, and they look at it and they go, yeah, it must be something with this guy's web page. Well, what a stupid thing to say. Of course it's not. How can you get the same people, take their same equipment, their tablet, their laptop or something, plug it in someplace else and get right to my web page? So it's not their equipment. Certainly it's not access to my web page. And how ridiculous. If you can't, you know, it's being diverted someplace in the middle. So anyway, we started doing what are known as trace routes. And this is a thing you can do. You can do it from your computer. Anybody can do it. You go to the start menu. You click on run. You type in CMD, which is for command. A little window pops up. You type TRACE space. No, it's TRACERT. That stands for trace route. Then a blank. And then you put in my web page. You just type it in, jmccanneyscience.com. Or you can put in the IP address, if people know the IP address. But at any rate, and then that tells you all of the hops on the way to get to my web page. The best we can figure out, Verizon is routing my web page, not anybody else's, so I'm getting a little bit of special treatment here, to Singapore, where it dead ends. Well, gee, I'm not in Singapore. Now, I've been a lot of places on the planet, but I'll tell you one thing. I'm not in Singapore. So anyway, bottom line, Verizon is blocking my web page. So if you have Verizon service, you will not be able to get to my web page. And, of course, they deny it. Well, the facts are the proof's in the pudding. Anyway, I don't want to dwell on that. My web page has been upgraded, and I've been putting a lot of time into this, dropping other things that I've been doing, and I got about 20 plates that I'm spinning up there at the same time, keeping them going, plus my research in the background. But my web page, go look at it, because I'm very happy with this. It's expanding by a lot. One thing I'm very proud of is for a long time, I've had 10 Mega World projects. These are worldwide projects that deal with the things that have to be done in the world. And actually, I've expanded the list now to 11. I don't want it to grow too big because these are major, major, major undertakings, mega world projects. And, of course, there are many other smaller projects. I'm not going to give a lot of detail. Go to my webpage and see these. But one that I'm working on right now, which is imperative, is to drain the Lake of Yellowstone. Oh, this is so absolutely imperative, important. In the last 20 million years, there have been three major explosions that have come out of Yellowstone. Three of them in the last 2.1 million years. One of them 630,000 years ago. And looking at the cycle of explosive volcanoes coming out of Yellowstone, some of the other ones were farther west in Idaho. But it's the same volcanic system. But at any rate, this baby is getting ready to blow. And we got to get that water out there. It's called a super thermal hyperthermal, there's a various geological names for this, explosive volcano. And what happens is you take the water. Now, this lake, I forget, it's like 130 miles long, 400 feet deep, and in the caldera of an old volcanic caldera that has dropped down. It's where the land drops down after a volcanic eruption. And that lake has filled in with water. When that water drops down through the fissures, then it can when it hits the magma, it turns to superheated steam. I've got a little write-up. I'm not going to go through all this. I want you to go to the webpage and read about this. But John Moore, my good friend, I'm on his show regularly every Wednesday morning. A lot of people tune in to listen to that show, too, on Wednesday morning. But the John, and I figured I needed a point man. I needed somebody to talk in my behalf as a scientist. I needed somebody who was an investigative reporter type that could go to the government agencies and solicit them to take heed and get this accomplishment. He went to the Park Service. He went to the state of Wyoming, the governor, the senators, the legislative bodies, the people in Washington, and the U.S. Geological Survey. John went to these agencies, called them up, and of course got passed off to staff members, and literally it went nowhere. One woman, John told me, he called up and he got passed off to a staff member. Her response was, "What is a volcano?" Boys and girls, grandmas and grandpas, we are dealing with the most incompetent, nincompoop idiots. As I said on my webpage, the people in these government jobs are simply waiting for retirement so they no longer have to pretend to do something. That's the state of government science agencies, geological, whatever you want to, or, and especially in the political realm. These people are in Disney World pretend La La Land. We are dealing with gross incompetence from the very lowest level to the very highest level. But at any rate, we have to get the water, and I show how to do it. The southeastern, there's a drainage path that already is there out the southeast. It's the southern arm. It's in the southeast corner of the lake. And it drains out through a channel. It would be easy to open that up, let the water drain out, and then you would not have a superheated thermal volcano. There would just be a lava flow, which would not be the greatest thing on the planet, but it's not going to destroy the planet. And I show the ash fallout for the three previous explosive volcanoes that came out of Yellowstone, and they killed off all the way to eastern Nebraska. So I've been to those sites. I've been to the museum in Nebraska. I've been to a museum in South Dakota that were covered with ash, and the animals were buried there due to the eruptive activities of the volcanoes in that Yellowstone chain. Like I say, historically, as you go back 10 million, 20 years, the volcanoes erupted from west of Yellowstone, what is now Yellowstone, back into Idaho, but it's the same what they call hot spot, moving under the ground and then erupting farther east, kind of moving easterly. Okay, enough of that, but go to the webpage. I have especially to the picture of the day subpage. I'm trying to get a picture up every day, and I've been filling in the blanks going back into 2014 and putting up pictures and then explaining them. Also, I want to make a quick announcement here. I have a new offering coming up, and I think this is something a lot of people are going to like. I started a number of years ago. It's actually available on my webpage. It's called the DVD Lecture Number 1, the first of a 20-series DVD lecture series. I believe it's about a three-hour lecture on a DVD. And it's setting the tone for a series of lectures. And so I hope many of you already have that. If you do, go back and review it, put it in the DVD player. and listen to that DVD. It's like I say, it's setting the path for the future lectures. And I'm starting, I've got the equipment set up, I've been filming, I've been putting the background together, putting the educational part together. But what I'm doing is I'm actually expanding on that concept. At first, I was going to do conferences. And, of course, I couldn't do travel conferences. It would just be prohibitive. And traveling in these days of peril, et cetera, gets actually kind of dangerous. And so I've stopped making public appearances many, many years ago because the government people show up, and it really gets kind of strange, let me just put it that way. Lots of wonderful, wonderful people. But you always get, when I show up, the government, let's call them the people that are sent to cause problems are there, and people that are just there just listen to record, etc. I'll just tell you a little story. I was in this was in Denver. Went out to Denver. This was back in the early 2000s, and there was a conference which I had been invited to, but then I said no, I'm not going to go. It's just I'm not going to have travel. I'm just going to bypass that one. And at the last minute, it turned out some people I was with decided we were going to go out to Denver and take just a tour through the mountains, kind of a vacation. And I thought, you know, doggone, I missed this conference. I could have been. It was right at the same time I could have been at that conference giving a talk. So I called up a friend of mine, a guy named Mark Hazelwood, and Mark was on the agenda to talk. And he says, well, what I'll do is I'll give you half of my time there. He had a two-hour slot to talk. So he got up and he talked for really only about 15 minutes, and he said, by the way, there's a guy named Jim McCanny here that, and everybody was like, wow, Jim McCanny's here. And he says, I'm going to give the rest of my slot to him. So I got up and I gave a talk. And actually, you can see that talk on my DVD set number 1 and 2. It's one of the historical important talks that I gave. Plus, on that DVD, also, I have the conference, the small group conferences that we had later, that was filmed, and that's also on that DVD. But at any rate, this is the point I'm trying to get at. After my talk, I go out to the pool area at the hotel, and you know, the conferences, a lot of people are staying there. So I'm at the pool, I'm there by myself, and there's a guy in a suit, very nicely dressed, with his briefcase, and I come walking in, and it's full of tape recording cameras and equipment, so that when he closed that briefcase, it recorded and did on film everything that was going on. And he saw me, and he came and he saw me looking at his equipment. Obviously, I saw all his equipment. He goes, well, I guess you know what I'm doing here. And I go, I guess I do. And he talked to me. It was very nice, congenial. And he goes, he asked me, he says, I got a question for you. How exactly is this? You're not on the speaker roster. You come in here. You are the highlight of the show, and everybody wants to listen to what you have to say. And he says, how exactly do you do that? And I said, well, you know, there's I guess a few people know me. So at any rate, that was his comment. He couldn't quite understand how somebody could simply walk in off the street, get up in front of a group of people, 1,000 people, and be very popular, well-known, and very well-received. Anyway, at any rate, getting back to the story, I'm setting this started the DVD series, so the DVD actually number 3 is the first, it's called DVD number 3 on my webpage, it's the first of a 20 DVD series, lecture series. What I have decided to do, the reason I was telling you that little story is because, like I say, public speaking, I used to do a lot of it, and that's just gotten too kind of strange. The government people come out of their woodwork, and I just don't want to deal with it anymore. So here's what I'm doing. I'm going to do this DVD. I'm going to keep this ongoing, but the point I want to make, I'm starting courses. And these are going to be high-level, college-level astrophysics, astronomy, space science courses. And it's going to take a progression. They're going to be released one at a time, and then I'm not going to pre-release the topics until they're actually ready to be put on the internet. The other thing is I now have the capability, and the internet has the capability, and most people out there have the capability of downloading large files. Now, video is very common, where it wasn't a number of years ago. Video is very common, and so I'm going to be releasing these on the internet from my page. They'll be very large files, and you will, when you buy it, you'll have a time slot in which you can go in and download these big, big files. And then there will be web pages that you only have access to, etc. These are going to be high-level, university-level astrophysics, space science, astronomy courses with the material that I put together, but in a sense that you will be able to understand, because I want the public to be really highly educated. So I encourage people to read my books. That's the starter. You have to read my books. You have to understand them and all of them. You have to go through those books. That's the basis. And then I'm going to start taking people to the next level, because we're going to start going off of this planet someday. I have one of my major projects is the Wing Project, to get us off of coal, nuclear, and oil as energy sources in the next 10 years. Another project is to get us into outer space. And these private space programs that are going on are not going to cut it. They're still using chemical rockets, a bunch of baloney. But we need to get a lot of people off of this planet. And the United States government is doing everything it can do to prevent you, the public, from getting off this planet. So anyway, there's a whole great deal of education that has to go on amongst the people. And so once you get into outer space, there's no place to spend your money. There's no 7-Eleven. There's a whole new way of living and breathing, almost. Okay, so anyway, I want to keep people tuned. Watch my webpage, watch for announcements on these new course developments, and they will be available. So just watch for that coming down the road. Actually, many people have been asking, when am I going to get back into that level of teaching? And of course, there's boatloads of free information on my webpage, on the radio show. This is all free. You don't have to pay a dime. And that's the one thing that my detractors hate about me. Number one, I do all of this. It doesn't cost you anything. They hate that. They want sponsors where they can come in and control content in radio shows. The second thing is that the thing they really hate about me is I put this in terms that you can understand, because see, what they want is they want lines and lines of doctors and PhDs that, I got to listen to this guy, he's a PhD, I sure don't understand what he's saying, but he must be right because he's got a PhD. That's what they want. They want you thinking, and that's what, remember Carl Sagan? He actually said that. He said, don't try and understand it. You will never understand it. Just take my word for it, because I'm smart and you're dumb. That was Carl Sagan's message, and that's the message that is brought to you by Standard Science today. Oh, let's make dark matter and black energy and relativistic this and black holes and Big Bang, you know, billions of years ago, the first 3 minutes. Nobody can understand this except the so-called hierarchy religion of gobbledygook science. And unfortunately, it's that way in mathematics and many of the fields of mathematics. But what I do is I bring science to the level that everybody can understand, and they hate me for that. They hate me because I'm not standing behind a PhD or lines and rows and columns of government-paid scientists. You can understand this stuff because I'm teaching it to you in a way that you can understand and at a level which professional scientists can understand. So anyway, let me switch gears here. I talked over a week ago, or actually this was on the John Moore Show also, I made a prediction. It was on the 28th Wednesday, the 28th of January. I said, you know, we got this electrical alignment coming up. I really haven't said much about it, but it's going to start on January 29th, which was the Friday afterwards. And I said, we've got little Mercury coming around. It's going to be a perfect direct electrical alignment, Mercury, Earth, and Jupiter. And we usually get a pretty good blast from Jupiter. I call them the Jupiter winds, and I've talked about this before. And so anyway, boom, the 29th, it didn't quite happen on the 29th. It took about a day for all of this interaction to take hold. But the whole next week, the entire Earth was just labeled. And it was a tremendous thing to watch. The storm activity in the South Pacific and South America, just exploding. Europe had tremendous storms up around the poles, both the poles, especially the North Pole. Siberia took a tremendous beating, and we had major snowstorms. But here's one thing I wanted. I actually posted this on my webpage. We had 45-mile-an-hour winds off the main coast. And what's strange is there weren't any other wind sources around it. It was just like one spot where there were 45-mile-an-hour winds. And I have that posted. I have the wind maps posted on my webpage. But just strange to see those kind of things. Plus, we had a hurricane form off of Alaska, southwest of Alaska. Since then, another one formed and dissipated also, and these swept across Canada and the United States, dumping more snow than the predicted storm Juno. And the other point I want to make is that the National Weather Service did not predict any of this. And so, anyway, that happened last week. That's a posting on my webpage. The webpage picture of the day, I will be using those as basis for some of my lecture material for this show. And so people can see that, read about it on the webpage, and then listen to the show and get some more interaction. Here's a listener email. Someone wrote in and they said, why is Greenland covered with ice? And these are actually very strange situations because they called Iceland Iceland because it was covered with ice. Now Iceland is relatively free of ice, and Greenland is covered with ice. But the entire scenario there, I don't have direct answers for these. Let me put it this way: I don't have answers for everything that exists on this planet. And so sometimes it's good that people admit, like, yeah, this is something I'd have to study, I'd have to look into it a little bit more. But it's a very good question. It's something that I'm going to look into a bit more. But one of the mega projects that I have related to this question is that we know that the 95% of the world's fresh water is locked up into the ice caps of Greenland, the North Pole, and Antarctica. Antarctica is melting quite a bit, although over the past 2 years, the extent of the ice shelf has increased. Remember a couple of years ago, all of the global warming alarmists were saying, well, look at all of these ice shelves are breaking off and falling into the sea. And the land mass in Antarctica, the South Pole continent, is warm, and so the ice sheets are literally sliding off into the ocean. And so that's partly what was going on here. But you have to ask yourself, why is Antarctica, why is the land mass under miles and miles of solid ice, why isn't it frozen? That doesn't make much sense at all. Well, the reason is because Antarctica was in a temperate climate a number of thousands of years ago. And when it shifted, when the pole shift occurred, when Venus the comet came by prior to it becoming a planet, it shifted in one of the situations was that the South Pole at that time was just open ocean. And this I describe in my books. I describe the little book, Surviving Planet X Passage, has a nice description of the physics of how pole shifts work. And it's a rotational dynamics situation where a gravitational wave is induced into the surface and mantle of the Earth, and it slides over because there's a viscous layer of molten rock, basically. There's a viscous layer. And so the surface slides over the inner part. The inner part remains rotating in the same direction it was before. And then the surface catches up again. I always tell people that have a hard time imagining these concepts. Take two eggs, hard boil one of them. Or actually, you could take three eggs. Hard boil one of them, soft boil the other one, and leave the other one raw. And the soft boiled one, have it pretty well hardened, but not completely in the middle. And that gives you that viscous layer, that same situation. All you have to do is take these and spin them on a table. And this is one of the tests for a hard-boiled egg. Spin the egg on a table. The hard-boiled egg will continue to spin because when you imparted the angular momentum, the angular velocity to that egg, the core spun with the shell. The shell was locked, it's solid, it's going to spin, the whole thing spins. And you may not notice it, but a lot more energy went into spinning the hard-boiled egg. But once it's spinning, the whole thing continues to spin. Now spin the raw egg on the table. Spin it as hard as you can, and within one revolution, that baby is stopped. And so this is what Earth is like. Earth has a viscous layer. And so when that gravitational wave works on the outer mantle of the Earth, as a large cometary object comes by at high speed. And once I did an entire show on the factors of gravitational waves affecting planetary mantles and crusts. And so the entire concept was, how fast is it going? How big and massive is this object? And how close does it come to Earth? Talking about a term I coined called action at a distance. And so that's a term I coined in my work. Action at a distance, and not only gravitational, but electrical, magnetic, you name it. And of course, lots of people have tried to copy this concept, except they get it all twisted upside down and backwards. There were people who were saying that magnetic fields cause the pole shift. Well, no, magnetic fields don't, because the magnetic fields are typically plasma magnetic fields. The majority of Earth's magnetic field is due to electric currents outside the planet, not something inside the planet. And so that's why we can record magnetic field fluctuations with solar storms, because the bulk, I've identified this in my book, there's five magnetic field layers to the Earth. There's a very small contribution in the core. And standard science says that the majority of the magnetic field is in the core. Well, it's simply false. The majority of the Earth's magnetic field is in layers. There's a little bit locked into the surface. And when you have a magnet in your hand, and you're standing right on the surface of the Earth, remember that the magnetic forces are very short-ranged. And so, like, if you're on a place on Earth, nickel and iron are the primary sources of magnetic field on Earth. So your compass is measuring the locked-in magnetic field at the surface of the Earth. But that doesn't extend very far up in above the surface of the Earth. Now you have the ionosphere. There's three co-rotating ionospheric belts of electricity. There's the two, the northern and the southern hemisphere belts go easterly. The electron belt, which is runs around the equator, runs westerly. So that's another layer of magnetic field. That couples with the Van Allen belts, which are relativistic electrons and protons, also in counter-rotating belts rotating around Earth. They couple with the larger scale magnetic field, which is caused when the solar wind comes in to the Earth. The protons and electrons see the magnetic field. They split. The electrons go one way. The protons go the other way, causing and driving more of our magnetic field. So our magnetic field is in many, many layers, primarily plasma. And it has nothing to do with the Earth. So the concept that something could come by and cause a magnetic field pole shift is ludicrous. Besides, it's well known that Venus doesn't even have a magnetic field. So how could it impart a magnetic field pole shift when it doesn't even have a magnetic field? So the whole point is that the pole shifts are caused by gravitational waves and gravitational waves only in the surface of the Earth. So the entire point here is that the Earth shifted dramatically during that Venus encounter, and the end result is that we have a new polar cap on Antarctica. That's why the land is warm there. If you go down far enough, you're going to find mastodon bones, I guarantee you. And anyway, that is sliding off, and those are sliding off, the ice caps of Antarctica are sliding off into the ocean, and they will continue to do that. But remember, constantly there's a hydrological cycle in which water is built up on the ice caps, the northern ice cap and the southern ice cap. There's a great story. I love telling this story. There were in the World War II era, there was a fleet of prop engine fighter planes. They were on mission up around the Arctic, and they were forced to land. They went out and saved them. They got these guys to come back, and about 40 years later, these guys got together in a reunion, and they said, you know, it'd be great if we could go back up to that. They knew right. They had the coordinates. They knew exactly where the longitude and the latitude of where they had to force land. They said, let's go back there and get those planes. And the guy said, that's a great idea. Let's go back there. So they go exactly back to the same spot. Nothing there. Nothing there. And they go, well, what's going on? So they start digging. And I can't remember how far down they had to dig, but it was a long way, and they found the planes. Just sitting there, just like they had left them, but covered with, I can't remember. It was hundreds and hundreds of feet of ice, but they found the planes. And so the moral of the story is that the caps are building up very quickly. And back when that pole shift occurred, remember the Earth was plummeted into basically a mini ice age. And so those caps built up very, very quickly. But let's fast forward up to today. 95% of the Earth's fresh water is locked into the North Pole, the South Polar Cap, and Greenland. Okay, so what we got to do is some of that water is melting and running off into the ocean. What we have to do is trap that water and move it to places that need fresh water. That's one of my Earth mega projects. Not only move that water and harvest and manage it, but also to remove the ownership of water from corporations, from banks. The ownership of water is a something that just should not be at all. It should never be. It should never have ever gotten started. Where governments are divvying up water rights or giving them away or selling them to international corporations. No, absolutely not. Every plant, animal, and person, human being and animal, not just humans, but animals and plants need water on this planet. It's a right, it's a birthright of everything living on this planet. We live on a water planet and everything we know that's alive depends on it. And so anyway, we have to manage that good stewardship of the planet. And so under my mega project of harvesting that water, there's a whole long list of water issues. And by the way, when you read my page on the 11 mega world mega projects, you'll find that they actually fall into categories of food, water, energy, the preservation of the species. These are things that have to be done to expand and get this Earth back into shape, get it back from the greed, the corporate greed, which has taken over and destroyed it, the world banking greed, which many people love to live in this system because they get a paycheck. Okay, so anyway, make sure you visit the webpage. That was a listener question. That's that whole commentary started out with a listener question. So let me get into the main science topics here. Today I'll be talking a little bit about something called dark matter. And I've spent quite a bit of time on the Picture of the Day subpage slamming this concept. When I was at Cornell, I encountered the astrophysics department, the people there, a guy named Ed Saltpeter, who is now deceased. So I'll try and speak kindly of him, but at any rate, had a number of discussions with him about something called the missing mass, invisible matter, dark matter. These are all the same names for the same thing. This idea that they're talking about today of dark matter is not new. This goes way back. And every time they introduce it, it's because the physics don't add up. The physics theories, something is missing, so they have to invent something. I call it a Schwann's factor. That's in the laboratory back in college. The kids didn't have time. They didn't want to do a good job. They were trying to do a sloppy, quick job to get it done. And the data didn't make sense. They didn't know what they were doing. So what they would do is they'd start writing the experiment up, the experimental write-up. They'd start writing from the beginning. And then they knew what the answer was supposed to be, so they'd start for that, and then they'd work backward. And then somewhere in the middle, hopefully the professor didn't notice, they'd include a magic factor to make the two connect. Let's put it that way. Well, that happens with professionals, too. But dark matter is nothing but a giant Schwann's factor in theoretical astrophysics. Back in the late 1970s, when I was at Cornell, they needed it in the model for galactic evolution. What they said was that two galaxies or two galactic blobs of dust and gas came somewhat together, influenced each other. It started a density wave to roll around in the galaxies, and that's what made the arms form. This was one of the primary theories taught today regarding galactic formation. The only problem is that, I mean, all of the pretty pictures look nice, but the one thing I pointed out was that it didn't explain the symmetry. It did not explain the symmetry in galaxies. There is tremendous symmetry in galaxies, and that's something I point out in the picture of the picture of the day subpage. Go look at that information and look at the symmetry. In fact, I have an exercise also that you can do measuring the symmetry of galaxies. It's in the first column on my webpage. Look down the first column for the galaxy. It's a little problem. It's an exercise that you can do. But at any rate, they said, well, if we put this invisible matter out into the arms region, they didn't say how this happened or how it got there or what properties this matter has, other than it's invisible and we can't see it or detect it, then that would solve their problem. It would make the light curves, because what they did is they took red shifts and blue shifts, took the spectrum of light coming from the arms of galaxies. And the red shift meant that the arms, that was for the arm moving away, and then the blue shift was for the arm that was coming swinging around towards you. And what happened was the light shift data didn't match the orbits that you would get if these stars were simply moving around in circular orbits. And so what did they do? They introduced dark matter, and that gets to be a more complicated topic. I will be talking about this in a very high level with equations and mathematics. And also remember when I'm doing that I'll be explaining this so that everybody can understand this, even though you might not have a great background in mathematics. But you have to look at what has happened historically. So anyway, that was one of the reasons for having dark matter. Now fast forward to the Big Bang era, which is today. Everybody talks about the Big Bang, which I don't believe in. There's no indication that there ever was a Big Bang. The data doesn't add up. And once again, what do they need to make the data fit in the expanding universe? It doesn't make any sense, so they have to introduce dark matter. Invisible matter, and they don't know what the properties are. They don't know where it came from. 98% of the matter, they say, in the universe has this form, but there's no way to detect it. They don't know what the properties are. But if every time they see an X-ray, every time they see a gamma ray, oh, it must be dark matter. It's like weather prediction. they have all of these things. Remember the polar vortex, the magical polar vortex causing all our weather? Well, nobody could tell you why there's a polar vortex or what it was. We never had one before. Why all of a sudden now do we have polar vortexes? Well, it's what they needed to explain things that they couldn't explain. But dark matter, at any rate, the need for that is a theoretical need, because their basic theoretical structure of the universe does not add up. Once you look at the data, it doesn't make any sense. So they have to invent invisible matter, that 98% of the universe is in this form. Now, just imagine how stupid this is. All of the matter that we can see, everything we can see, has one property. Once it gets to even a moderate size of conglomeration, it becomes visible. It starts giving off light. It forms stars. It gives off light. It gives off some kind of signal that it's there. And they're saying 98% of the matter in the universe doesn't fit this. They don't have any laboratory model. There's no laboratory proof. But many, many, many people are employed in looking for dark matter. If you look at any Gee Whiz popular magazine for astronomy, or Discover magazine, or National Geographic, whatever it is, you know, they're talking about dark matter. And the reality is, unless they actually get some physical properties strapped onto this and actually make some measurements, then there's no point in even talking about it. So why all of this, the discussion? Okay, the topic number two, warped galaxies. And now you might wonder, why am I going off and talking about galaxies and dark matter and, you know, cosmology? Well, really, it's the beginning. And if you understand how galaxies really form, which is one of my early peer-reviewed published papers, that's why I want to start with that, because it shows how the twin star systems come out of the galaxies, of the center of the galaxies, form the arms, and that this forms the initial twin star pairs. Sometimes they're triplets, like three stars, but there's never any more. They come out either twin stars or triple stars, and then the solar systems, the star systems, start to adopt planets one at a time by capture. And so anyway, it's important to understand the basics of galactic formation before you can put in the concept of how solar systems and planetary systems form. Okay, now you can fast forward to today. All of a sudden, NASA is discovering dozens and dozens of planets. And, you know, not more than dozens. They're discovering hundreds of planets. And out far where they never thought there were any before, and they're kind of scratching their head or whatever they scratch there, trying to figure out, well, where are these coming from? They have no clue. Some of them are very big. I made a point a number of weeks ago announcing that they're finding very large planets, and they're actually calling them Planet X. Planet X is simply an astronomical term for planets that have not been named yet. So they are discovering these. They're finding big ones, and they've only scanned a very small percentage of the sky. And they only go out so far. Is there's a tremendous amount of sky that still has to be researched, but in the initial stages of this search, which goes back about 5 years or more, actually many, many years, they've been doing this for a long time, only in secret, they are discovering many, many planets. But they don't know where they came from. And the first word out of their mouth, it's the only thing you can say, is that they were captured. Some form of capture is going on. And somebody asked me, they said, well, I don't understand this concept of capture. Oh, it was, I think it was Maria Heller the other day. I was a guest on her show out in Arizona, and she has a large listening audience. I'm a regular guest on that show. She said, I don't understand this concept of capture. And I said, okay, let's look at it this way. First of all, let's look at the capture process in reverse. When we send a satellite, a man-made satellite, out to, say, Pluto, like the New Horizons project that's arriving at Pluto, we don't have enough rocket power to get that thing going fast enough to get it out there in reasonable amount of time. And some of these can take as much as 10 years to get out to a faraway planet like to Pluto. So what we do is we take that satellite and zip it by something like Jupiter. And there's a way to do it. If you do it just right, it's like a slingshot. It picks up energy. Jupiter loses a little bit of the smidgen of energy, of its energy in its orbit. And that spacecraft picks up just the tiniest little bit. But in a spacecraft world, that's a lot of energy. It slingshots it out there, and it speeds up by a tremendous amount. And so that zips it out then to Pluto much faster. Okay, let's look at that process in reverse. If something is coming into the solar system, coming in very fast, if it comes by Jupiter or any of the other planets just right, it loses energy, and thus it drops into the solar system and becomes a regular member of the solar system. That is capture. So the whole point is, the whole point that I made back in my early work, when I was at Cornell, I was presenting all this information. I had to replace the entire set of solar system formation, galaxy formation, what comets are, the electrical nature of the universe. All of this came out in one big package, and that's why, I mean, they just didn't know what to do with me, because I had changed literally everything, every major concept. In fact, the idea of the induced electric dipole redshift showed that the Big Bang was not correct, that the redshifts were due to electrical conditions around normal galaxies, and that the distance that they were talking about, the Hubble constant and all of that, was all not true, that the redshifts were literally due to electrical conditions around the stars, and it was caused by what I call the induced electric dipole redshift. And that's something that actually has been proven. I have shown it in a laboratory. So literally every concept that's taught as standard fare in astronomy, astrophysics, and space science is incorrect. So at any rate, this is why I'm saying, when you start with galaxies, you have to, when you start talking about solar systems and solar system formation, planetary system formation, you have to understand where the initial two stars came from. In our case, it's the Sun and Jupiter. Possibly there was a third one there. But there's a whole system of statistical dynamics that have to be studied to understand twin stars, triple stars, etc., and then the whole process of capture. You need at least two stars to start capturing. And that's why when you see these forming as they come out of the galactic arms start forming and the twin stars forming, that's the basis for star system, planetary systems in the future. So that's why I'm starting out with this entire story of galaxies. And then also what I do is I take the proposed theories that have been put on the table over the past, going back into history, and I show why one by one each of them cannot possibly be true. And so, at any rate, you have to look at all of the features of galaxies. The model that I proposed is very basic. It's simply a dust cloud collapsing in on the nucleus. The nucleus is a much larger than average star that's formed. So the dust clouds start to collapse. As they collapse, they start spinning faster and faster. The same concept that a skater, when a skater is skating, they pull in their arms and they spin faster. And so what happens as the dust and gas clouds collapse and they're rotating, they form a plane. The rotation ends up having an average rotational momentum, angular momentum, and that forms a plane, a spin axis, and an equatorial plane. And so here's what happens. As the pressure builds up from the outside, now this becomes a fluid flow problem. You have pressure coming in from all sides. This is spinning. Now, what's happening to the stuff that's down in the middle? It becomes higher and higher pressure down in the middle. and this is one thing, then I applied fluid dynamics. What happens in a three-dimensional model when you have collapsing gas clouds that continually are coming in and they're building up more and more pressure? What happens is that there become two outlets, and this is a fluid flow problem. You can show that there will only be two outlets, and that's the most efficient way to get the material out from below. And let me give you another example, something that's commonly known on Earth. You drill a well for oil down deep in the ground. The oil is under a tremendous amount of pressure because rock is built up on top of it, and you have an oil, basically a lake of oil down there that is a deposit, and it's under a lot of pressure. If you put a pinhole or a 1 foot diameter hole down into that oil, because of the pressure all around, that oil comes shooting up the pipe, and remember the old Texas geysers? When they would hit oil, the oil would come shooting out, and then they'd have to cap it. And this is what happened big time with the BP oil spill. They went down to 18,000 feet and were drilling in oil caverns down there, and that oil came out with so much pressure they couldn't cap it. That's what happened, and they didn't have the technology. BP oil didn't have the technology to cap it. Other companies did, but they wouldn't let the other companies come in and cap that. So they just let it roll off into the Gulf of Mexico, destroying everything. What a bunch of idiots. But anyway, that's another example of fluid that's under great pressure down deep. The same thing happens around a galactic nucleus. And as I say, as this gas and dust comes in, collapses, it builds up more and more pressure. Something's got to give. And so the down below, still in basically liquid form or highly concentrated gas form, you might say, but basically this is a fluid flow problem. The fluid is going to find its way out from down deep, and that's the easiest path out is in diametrically opposed paths and in the form of a pipe, a circle. A square pipe is going to have much more viscosity for the amount of fluid moving through it, so the best, easiest path is through a tube, basically a tube coming out both sides, and as it's spinning, the arms come flowing out. Now, if you look at the statistics of what happens to this fluid as it comes out, it starts to solidify and form into clumps. And those clumps start spinning around each other gravitationally. And very early in the process, now, the other thing that at that time, the Russians were doing a tremendous amount of statistical analysis of gravitational systems. And so I applied that to my work, and I showed that the statistics of what the Russians showed was that the twin stars were the only, were the two stars orbiting each other, would be the largest group. All of the other members, if there were more members in those initial sets, would be tossed out. So what happens is you have this tremendous interaction going on as stars are solidifying, moving out in that galactic arm, and then becoming twin stars. And so those twin star systems start moving out, or triple star systems, also many are in triple star systems, start moving out, and that's it. There's no planetary systems. They're going out simply the star systems. Okay, there's a rich amount of material there, and as that material starts to conglomerate into other smaller pellets, you might call them on this scale, of material, of coagulated material, they start coming in and becoming captured. And this is the initial state of organization of a solar system. As these move out, they might only have one captured planet for the next 100 million years until they start capturing other bodies one at a time. As they get way out in the arm, now the arms are expanding outwards. And so if you want to see the reprint of this paper, the paper was actually published in Astrophysics and Space Science in 1980. If you see the paper, it has my name and the Department of Mathematics at Cornell. That's because I had already moved to the Department of Mathematics from the Physics Department when that paper was published. So it's published under my name, Department of Mathematics, Cornell University, and it's called Continuing Galactic Formation. It's reprinted in by permission of the Dutch Netherlands company, the publishing house that published that journal, and it was peer-reviewed, and so that's reprinted in Appendix 1 of my book, Planet X, Comets, and Earth Changes. So you can see that article, and it's talking about galactic formation. It also has a bit of mathematics. It also describes the reason for symmetry in galaxies. And this is going back to my experience at Cornell. When I tried to talk with Ed Salpeter in the halls, they were adamant that they were going to stay with this density wave model, which, well, I'll be talking more about that. And so when I do my coursework, when you look at the courses, I'll be going into these topics in great detail with charts and drawings and maps and computer work and equations, etc. And like I say, this will be on a level that really everybody will be able to understand. And the thing about it, a lot of people are afraid of equations. Well, when I teach you about how these work, you're going to understand. Probably many people for the first time will understand how mathematics works and how equations work. And so I think it'll be a wonderful experience for everybody. And not that everybody's going to understand it at the very highest levels, but you will understand the formation of galaxies, etc. And so once again, look for those courses that are coming out, and and they will be online. So be watching for that. Another picture that I have, I mentioned the warp galaxies. The other picture that I believe is still there right now is called Interacting Galaxies, showing how when two galaxies interact, they destroy one another. They don't create symmetry or symmetrical arms. They destroy each other. So the whole idea of density waves with two objects interacting gravitationally in outer space, they don't form arm systems. They don't form density waves. They destroy each other. In a very asymmetrical manner. Okay, well, just a couple of seconds left in this show. Remember the webpage, the many unique items there, like the recalendar, sun, star, clock, the pre-filter that fits any standard stainless or plastic water filter on the market. Very necessary for pre-filtering water in case of emergency. Some people use those every day because they have very bad well water. The pre-filter and the pre-filter accessory set. The stainless steel water filter line, and we just got 1,000 units of the stainless steel containers about a week ago. We had a tremendous run on those things before Christmas, including an emergency event in a foreign country, which wiped us out, but we're now well stocked again with the stainless steel, the plastic. And I'm out of time. Visit the webpage jmccsci.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.